get him on right now. Mr. Sean Waltman, are you there?
I'm here.
So great to have you. Finally.
I heard nothing but good things about your show, by the way. Not to blow smoke up your ass right off the bat.
No, please do.
Yeah.
Sorry, I missed. I saw Josh. What's his last name from the Hangover movie? Josh. I heard a little bit of him, but I missed Fran Drescher and Boss Rutten, Boss and I have been around each other a few times, and we've always had tons of fun. He's just like one of the most colorful, magnetic personalities like you ever want to be around. And the best, like, at one time, the best martial artist on the face of the earth, in my opinion.
I absolutely agree with that. I think, like, we were trying to get out of him. What do you think he'd be at right now in the MMA scene if it was in his prime? Where would you see Boss Rutten? What do you think? Do you think he'd be like a heavyweight champion, a contender?
I think he would probably be better at 205.
I agree.
Honestly, but he's got. See, I would, my first exposure to him was in Japan when I was going over there, and we were going over there at the same time, and I'd look in the wrestling magazines, and I'd see this ball-headed guy who was just, he looked jacked in the pictures, you know, but he didn't weigh a whole lot, you know, he was just in tremendous shape, and at first he was like wearing like gray gym shorts into the fight, you know, like, and it didn't even really, it looked like he had to borrow, you know, people's gear. Yeah, and he wasn't familiar at all with the submissions. That's why he got beat a couple times early. That's why Shamrock was able to get a victory over him, because Boss wasn't, you know, familiar fighting against guys, you know, grappling. And boy, but when he would hit somebody with an open hand, boy, it was like their head would explode almost. It was amazing. And the liver shots he would hit guys with.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And once he got the grappling down, he was untouchable over there.
Well, he was just telling us a story about how he worked for New Japan Pro Wrestling for Inoki.
Oh, he was great.
Yeah, and he said at one point he was actually supposed to do a job, and some guy started stiffing him really hard. He didn't understand that whole wrestling thing and how potatoes happen. And all of a sudden, he just wound up, smacked that guy right in the head, and knocked him out cold. So the referee,
I would rather get punched by anybody on earth than get smacked with an open hand by Boss Rutten.
Imagine that for the liver. Jesus Christ.
That and the liver shot, yep. And plus, he's got that O2 trainer thing that he came out with.
Oh, yeah,
that's just genius. That's genius.
So he's kind of like the DDP of MMA, kind of.
Yeah, except for, like, and I love DDP, but he's way funnier. Way funnier. He could be a movie. I mean, like, look at him in, what was that, Here Comes the Boom?
Yep.
Man, he was great. He stole that.
Yeah. He was actually on set while he was talking to us tonight. And I go, well, what kind of movie are you doing? And he's like, I'm doing this fun family comedy.
With Kirk Cameron.
With Kirk Cameron.
Oh, really? That, like, Kirk Cameron, he's like kind of the Christian actor now.
Yeah.
I told him he had to grab his ass for me. He's like, oh, okay.
And he will too.
That'll ruin Kirk Cameron's night. That'll ruin his night. I didn't realize he was such a big MMA fan. I mean, you put a new twist on wrestling, really. When you had debuted back in 93 for WWF, I mean, you threw those martial art kicks that you've never seen before on TV. Are you as rabid as a fan now of MMA?
Oh, totally. It's just, here's the thing. It's so, like, and I can't be the only one that you've heard say this, and you might even feel this way yourself. It seems to be oversaturated right now.
Yes, I agree.
Because I can't even name all the guys that are contenders and champions of different divisions right now. And you used to be able to name, like, the top guys in MMA on, like, not two hands, but, you know, there's only a couple of dozen of them that, you know, that were really well known, you know, at one time early on, kind of in the barbaric days of it too, you know.
Oh yeah. As much as people say that they are barbaric, like that is the term that we've used on many occasions. But I'll be honest with you, going back, even watching it now, 20 years later, Those are some damn entertaining fights. I mean, there's
hell
a lot
yeah,
of fun.
Joe Son getting punched in the balls by Keith Hackney over and over again.
Any Tank Abbott fight.
Take your pick.
Or Tank Abbott, yeah. Or I mean, I saw Keith Hackney hit a guy with the ridge hand, which is a traditional martial art technique that is really very. It's the first time I've ever seen it used in a real real fight. And man, he knocked this big Samoan guy out like cold.
I remember
so that.
That
was always sweet, man. When that was so sweet when guys didn't know each other's styles and were going out there and. You know, learning as they went. Now everybody's got everybody's number.
Very true. Looking for a different dynamic, absolutely. I need to ask you, wrestling-wise, I know you've answered all the questions you could possibly answer about DX and about NWO and the famous question. We're going to try to take it to a different place. Before we talk about
B-Roll. You take it anywhere you want, fellas. I'm, you know, third game.
Well, I'm really curious about back when you first got into the WWF or the WWE now, considering your size and how WWF back then was so much into the bodybuilder look and everyone was gigantic, was there a certain match or a certain thing that maybe got you an initial look from WWF back then?
There was several things. Number one was I was discovered. I got to give a lot of credit to Joe Pedicino, who was like the brainchild of the Global Wrestling Federation, which kind of took over from World Class Wrestling on from the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas. And so I was on ESPN back when there wasn't as many cable networks at all back then. I was on ESPN every day kids got home from school. I was on 4 o'clock. So that was huge. Pat Patterson knew a guy in Minneapolis where I was building my name, and putting on really, really, really spectacular matches with Jerry Lynn. He knew this guy named Roger Buck that kept pushing me to Pat Patterson. Oh, you got to take a look at this guy. And finally, I got a call from Sergeant Slaughter, you know, and I was promoting a show at the time. And, like, I forgot Sarge was working in the office there, and I thought he was trying to get on the show, so I put him on hold for, like, 5 minutes, you know, and he's trying to get me to come in for a tryout. Finally, I realized what's up, you know.
Well, one thing I remember seeing you, one thing I thought you were going to actually mention was there was I was a big tape trader back in the day. I'd love to get my hands on anything that was out of the East Coast area. We're here in New York. And one thing I remember seeing that really struck a chord back then was you and Sabu.
Oh, yeah.
That's the show I was telling you about. That's the show that I was promoting that I thought Sarge was calling about. It was all right around that same time.
Wow. That was such an amazing match, especially for its time. And still
for the time. For the time. Both Sabu and I both look back at it now, and we totally see the mistakes we made. You know, when you wisen up, you look back at stuff you did. And I know you guys got to probably do the same thing at your old stuff. You know, you go, oh, God, sometimes you cringe, you know. Yeah. But, still, it put us, you know. I remember Sabu telling me that when he came in to WWE, when it was WWF, and Randy Savage came up to him and said, are you the famous Sabu that worked with Lightning Kid? And, like, that was a big deal to Sabu. He thought that was really cool, you know?
Yeah.
And so did I.
Yeah.
So did I.
That's awesome. So Sergeant Slaughter calls you. What does he call you in? Do you actually meet with Vince before you get signed? Like, how does that actually happen?
No, I just said, okay, I'll be there. They send me the plane tickets. At that time, I'm always in wrestling shape. And I get there. And there's Kurt Hennig at the airport because we're on the same flight. And I'm like, I got the droopy puppy dog eyes. And he goes, okay, kid, you come with me. And that was history right there.
Wow.
But Tony Garea, thank God, came to me and said, do you see anybody here you think you could have a good match with? Instead of coming to me and like they did so many times before with other guys with tryouts, they would come to him and say, oh, you got Virgil, or you got Brooklyn Brawler, or you got this certain guy that really had no vested interest in you getting the job at all. So he wasn't going to go out there and make you look good. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
So I picked Luis Spicoli. Best guy I could have possibly picked. Gave me two nights in a row. Just incredible stuff. People were going bonkers. Even Bret Hart was like, pulled me aside and was like, man, I just want to tell you how much I enjoy watching your stuff. And that was huge to me.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Huge,
I mean,
to anybody, man. Yeah, dude.
Yeah, and I already had a tour, my first tour, and I was going to sign a contract with New Japan. I was going for my first Super Junior tournament. But when WWF calls, you go.
Yeah.
And so I finished my Japan tour and then but before that, you know, after my tryout, I get a call from Vince probably about 6 weeks later, and I'm shitting, right? I'm like, oh my god, it's Vince McMahon, you know? And he runs the whole 1-2-3 kid storyline by me. And he goes, I just want to know if that was okay with you. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, that's the greatest freaking way anybody has ever been brought in ever.
Yep.
And really, come on. It really is. Because, I mean, most guys just get the generic. You come in and you get, you know, you got to try to get over in a few squash matches and try to get your persona over. And I mean, God, I just had it handed right to me. You know, mind you, I had to carry the ball once they handed it to me, but, you know, I was so excited, man.
Yeah,
I never thought it was going to happen.
I can't even imagine. And the one thing you just mentioned is squash matches, and that's something back in, like, the early 90s and the late 80s. I love the squash matches because it gave the guys an opportunity to really show highlight some of their moves that they don't actually do in some of the matches, and it really put guys over. I feel, and tell me if you agree with this, I feel that if we had squash matches every once in a while, it would really put different talents over much more than they are actually on TV now, instead of seeing the same matches over and over and over again.
Sure, as long as there's not a glut of them. You know what I mean? I mean, nobody wants to sit and watch a glut of... Because, I mean, we used to put the fans through torture, I swear to God, just to get a main event at the end of the night. I mean, you know, on a TV taping, you know, when we used to do Superstars, when that was the main thing, and we'd have to do a month's worth in one night, so 4 hours of TV, and that was all squash matches, very few feet, like, you know, competitive matches, and a few angles shot here. They would shoot their angles on Superstars, all the main angles. But, you know, and then, like, after the 4 hours of tapings were over, then they'd get their Coliseum home video main event house, you know, dark match, where guys are just trying to get it out of there as quick as they could.
And you know what? It's funny. I still right in the studio, actually, we have a couple Coliseum home videos from that era right now.
Those guys
in the
came
USA,
from the
1995.
They were adult video distributors before they started doing that Coliseum video.
Really?
They were.
That's very interesting. Wow. You know,
well, they
you
had
mentioned...
to, well, it made sense. I mean, as long as they weren't, you know, peddling WWE adult video, I mean, they already had all the distribution in place, so it kind of made sense for them.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I remember back in the day going to that local video store and renting those
grabbing
things.
Like a best of WWF volume, whatever.
19.
Right.
Yeah, I love those things. I grew up on them.
They were kind of cheesy, but there was a certain charm about. I still like to watch them. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. From time to time, just that opening.
Yep.
Very nostalgic.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's Andre slamming Kamala. I don't know why. That's one that's.
Yeah, that was like the epic when it turns the music.
God, yeah, don't we all have those memories in our heads of like, even just the theme songs of like Saturday night's main event? That you're my obsession. That beat that goes through my head all the time.
Now, the funny thing is, though, like, what do you think the kids of today will think about in 20 years from now? Are they going to think of. Is there a defining moment like that we're thinking of right now? Like, even like the intros to the shows. I remember what WWF Superstars was in 1992. And I don't know if they're going to have that same fond memories that we do. There's just so much information, so many matches, and so many different ways to watch wrestling, whether it be the internet or TV or DVR or DVD or Blu-ray. There's just so many options where I don't want to say it's oversaturated because, you know what, I love the WWE product. I love really any alternative except for TNA. But I just feel like they don't have what we had growing up, going out to that video store and searching for that Coliseum home video, and watching those matches, like and enjoying a squash match on a two-hour videotape.
It's just, but it's almost like, to see, the squash match is a lost art now. Nobody even knows how to do a squash match, fellas. Because like when I was at NXT a couple months ago, they were trying to explain to the talent there, like, okay, this is an enhancement match, and like you do these different, you know. And I had to go and explain to guys, like, hey, if you want to know how to do a textbook enhancement / squash match, you watch a Razor Ramon squash match when he first got to WWE. He knew how to do it. I mean, he was the perfect squash match guy. He knew how to grab, when to grab a hold so the announcers could talk about him. You know, he knew, like, what were the general rules of a squash match. Don't cover the guy too much, you know, because you don't want him kicking out of your shit too much. You know, give him a little bit, but not too much. So, a lot of guys, they just don't have the first clue how to do a squash match now, because you're limited in time. You're limited in time, and all they're thinking about is getting all their spots in. So when they get 5 minutes, they're going out there still trying to get all this shit in.
Now, we mentioned Razor Ramon. I mean, that was your big win. That was the angle that Vince talked to you about. Were you instantly accepted into the locker room?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, because we all kind of did business, like, you know, and came together, like, camaraderie-wise after the shows, you know, thanks to guys like Kurt Hennig and, you know, guys like that pushed that tradition of, like, everybody, you know, the boys getting together, having a good time, you know, going to the country bar. He was always a proponent of the best business was always done at the bars after the shows. And, you know, as far as, like, negotiating and trying to get, you know, somebody to do business with you that might be, you know, like a Roddy Piper that might have had a reputation of being hard to do business with, or, you know, allegedly that was his reputation, you know.
Yeah.
I always found him easy to do business with for the most part. But
was there anyone that ever refused to do a job for you, though, along the same line?
Oh, God, yes. Skip Young, Sweet Brown Sugar. From the Dallas. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I was just coming in as a Lightning Kid with this damn lightning bolt shaved in the side of my head by Burt Prentice. So,
Oh.
So, you know, and that was Skip's hometown, so he didn't want, you know, he didn't want the guys in the gym to think he wasn't tough anymore.
So what about, like, in WWE when you first come in? Do you ever have that problem at all?
Not to my face. I heard a couple of rumors, I was told that wasn't the case when I confronted the person about it. It was Papa Shango, I was told, didn't want to do that, and it was just time for him to leave. It had nothing to really do with me.
Yeah.
You know, because really, honestly, he's not a mark at all. Like he's just a good time guy that wants to just go out there and do business and get over and have fun and do whatever it takes to make the show better. So, you know, you hear things, and I know Jim Duggan was pissed off when he had to do a job for me in my first match in WCW.
I know because
he laid one of those big old forearms across my back, and my back immediately curled up like, oh my God, I hope I never get hit like that again.
Jesus. What's the best shoot fight you've ever seen in wrestling? Has there ever been like an altercation in a locker room or maybe even in the ring that you were just blown away like, holy shit, this is real, this is crazy?
Well, I mean, I've been involved in a few like that I wouldn't throw up there as like the greatest of all time, but like I got like down and dirty with the Villanos who are notorious in Mexico as being badass thugs.
Yeah.
Yep. And I was a 19-year-old kid in Japan, you know, and they were kicking the shit out of Jerry Lynn and I just started fighting back. And next thing you know, like, and I was just giving receipts, which means just giving tit for tat, you know. I wasn't hitting him any harder than he was hitting me. Next thing I know, I'm getting punched in the – I must have gotten, like, six good shots to the face. And I didn't drop, but I was I almost wish I would have been knocked out. Like, it discombobulated me so bad. But, you know, I've had to choke guys out and – different, you know, situations. A guy kicked me in the throat, and I, you know, out of anger, like took his head off, or you know, just different things. Like, but that's not shoots. That's not real shoots, because a real shoot is both guys going into the deal knowing it's going to be a real fight. Yeah. Because anybody can take a liberty on somebody when you're giving them your body. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yep. And that's not tough. There's nothing tough about that. That's cowardly, really, you know.
Yeah.
So and our business is about giving each other our bodies. It's not about killing each other, man. You know, like if you really got those problems, like settle them before you go out there.
Well, I agree.
Because that's what Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle did one night.
Oh, were you there for that?
I was there. You damn right I was.
You got to give us the details.
Well, were like that Brock was going around saying that, like, you know, he could take Kurt on the mat. You know, not like a street fight situation, but, you know, just bull of the woods, you know, alpha male type shit. And, you know, he had 65 pounds on Kurt Angle. But, like, apparently he didn't understand the difference between NCAA champion and Olympic gold medalist. And he got eaten up pretty good on the mat just wrestling.
Yeah.
If there was strikes involved, who knows what would have happened.
Wow.
You know?
That's awesome.
Interesting. Were you on that flight? That flight where him and Kurt
of course I was.
Oh, you gotta give us the details. What actually
every
happened?
Great thing that's ever happened, I was there.
So basically this is gonna be a 20-part interview.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
the flight from hell you're talking about.
Yeah, the flight from hell.
Yeah. Oh my God, so many different things happened on that flight. You had Kurt Henning and Brock Lesnar. Brock got stirred up about Kurt messing with him a little too much, and so Brock and Kurt end up having a takedown tournament in the aisle, and you know, bumping into the emergency exit door, which everybody made this big deal over when in reality you can't open an exit door when you're 30,000 feet there, no matter how hard you hit it or try to open it.
Yeah.
So I mean, there was it was just so out of hand, everything that, like, you know, every one little thing had, you know, had the microscope on it. I cut Michael Hayes's hair off. Yeah, and everybody popped huge. It was like the whole plane. If they were watching and waiting, and I milked it too. I had his hair in my hand. I had the scissors up in the air, like when a guy, like when a masked heel or somebody pulls out the old brass knucks out of their trunks and holds it up real high so the people in the top row can see it. So I'm holding the scissors up like that, and everybody's like, "You don't have the balls," and I just went chop. And the place went nuts. It was like the Road Warriors from 1985 just came through the curtain.
Speaking of craziness, what was it like working with Bob Backlund back in the day?
It was different because, like, you know, I had figured out what really got the reactions and how to do it efficiently. And it was fun to work with Bob because, I mean, he's a great wrestler and like a total legend. And I'm so honored that I did wrestle him, but it was a chore. It was a real chore because we both went out there and really wrestled. So, I mean, it wasn't easy a lot of the time until he figured out the formula of, like, on house shows. He would run around, jump over the rail, get the people all riled up, like he was crazy. He would do that for like 10 minutes. We would never touch. He would get back into the ring finally, and we'd go right home, right into the finish.
You know what's funny about that? I actually, someone sent me a video. I actually have one of your matches with Bob, like a handheld video camera, and that's word for word exactly what
it is.
What
it is, right?
15 minutes of that. Yeah, it's great.
And then he told me, like, he had told me, because I'd had a couple of good matches with him on TV. He told me, he says, I'm going to return the favor one day, I promise. And I appreciated that, but I just assumed that was just like him just being polite. And we got to Madison Square Garden, which was Bob Backlund's house after Bruno. That was the house with Bob Backlund after Bruno was gone. And it was supposed to be the same finish. I was supposed to put Bob over. He went up to Vince right in front of me, and he goes, "Tonight I want to put the kid over." And Vince just looked at him, and he goes, "You got it, whatever you want." And I did the O'Connor roll, which was a finish Bob used to use sometimes. Mm-hmm. So like I'm very, very proud and honored of that.
Actually, you know what's funny? We have people that send us videos all the time. I actually have a bootleg copy of that. Someone taped that match.
From the Garden? You're kidding me.
Yeah,
it's amazing how much bootleg stuff's out there, like handheld stuff. Because I used to get VHS tapes of, like, just nothing but just handheld, like, house show footage.
Yep. And it's so awesome to have because, like you said, like that's a memory you have and that it's out there. You know, we'll get you a copy because it is awesome. But it's so cool that people would actually go through those links. So think about it. Back then, those cameras were giant.
Three or four feet.
Sure, how do you sneak those into the building?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about Viva La Lucha, but there's so many more questions we have.
Hey, I'm fine, like, fuck, time-wise, so, you know.
All right, good.
You know, don't feel like you have to rush on my account unless you guys have time constraints.
No, not at all. I will say this, though. We're definitely going to have part 7.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah.
Kurt Hennig is a notorious ribber, and I wanted to know what the best rib that he's seen.
Wow. Kurt, he had these ribs that he would do that were just little, just things that would just subtly irritate you. Like, for instance, he'd take a master lock and lock it to your bag. So you had an extra lock, you know, jingling around on your luggage, you know, or he'd lock it to your Halliburton briefcase, which all the boys back in the day had a Halliburton briefcase. Or he'd like toothpick a guy's lock, you know, to his car, or he'd take a padlock and stick it to their hood ornament or their windshield wipers if it was snowing out. I mean, just things like that. You know, he was responsible for this big old giant billy club turd he put in this enhancement guy Rick Renslow's bag. First he put it out on the window seal, and it was like 20 below zero out. So it froze solid, like, you know, you could knock somebody out with it. Then he stuck it in Renfro's bag, and Renfro found it kind of, you know, later on. Greg Gagne actually tells that story in the Mr. Perfect video.
Does he really?
Yeah, he does.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's a great story.
I don't think he'll hear my poop stories being told in any WWE videos anytime soon.
We know your poop story. Are you the one?
Yeah, I just don't want Brock Lesnar beating the living shit out of me.
Really?
So come on.
Seriously, it happened way before him and Sable were together, but she was very unpopular, and I was kind of. I mean, it's something I've already admitted, and I own my stuff, and It was wrong. It was wrong. But at the time, it was like this huge deal that they hid their stuff. It was Rena and Mark Miro's last day for the company, and it was overseas in England, and it was a pay-per-view. And I'm at gorilla position getting ready to go to the ring to have a match with Shane, like a rematch on pay-per-view. And I said real quick, I said, "I got to piss." and I ran all the way across the building to where somebody had found their stuff, and I deposited the foreign object into her one of her bags, and she didn't find it, and she got all, until she got all the way back to Florida, you know, and it was like an international incident. She smuggled shit back to customs. But even Brock thought it was funny back then, you know. So hopefully, hopefully she'll accept my apologies and forgive me because it was wrong.
Well, another person that had a lot of shit in their life was Tammy, and we had so many people ask this question about Sonny, Tammy Sitch. So
yeah.
I'm going to quote this person that emailed us. Please ask X-Pac how much of a pig was Tammy Sitch.
I never thought of her as a pig, man. You know, because if a guy acted like that, everybody patted him on the back and said he was cool as shit. And like anybody that got all the women, you know, and was banging all the chicks, everybody like wanted to be that guy. But like, you know, she had a deal where she liked to bang.
Yeah.
You know, and
was there more?
And her and Chris. No matter what anybody says, people can say she was this and that to Chris, but I truly believe in my heart, knowing the both of them for many more years than just about anybody, that they had an arrangement. You know, they had an arrangement. I think he let her do her thing. You know, he loved her that much, and it was a dysfunctional relationship, obviously. Some heat started in Europe, and so she ended up getting the poop in the take home food tray.
Did Mark Henry eat that? Is that the story we heard?
No, Mark. If he did, if that story's true, it was a story. It happened when I was still in WCW. I didn't make the news. I only reported it during that during that segment where I dressed up like him, you know.
Because
the last guy I want mad at me is Mark Henry, because, you know, I mean, even just playing around, that guy could kill somebody.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
And he's a good guy, you know. He's a really good guy.
Yeah,
he's scary.
Yeah, he is.
He's a scary dude.
Very scary dude.
I do know who did it, but I will never say.
Now, we were talking about like the era of like 94, 95, 96. I mean, you got really good in with Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Shawn Michaels, formed the Click. Now, seeing that your three best friends are the top three WWF stars in the company, and they kind of use you as the workhorse, and you were the guy that would try to get those guys to the next level. Was there any jealousy whatsoever between you and do you have any jealousy towards the other guys?
No, because we all had our jobs. You know, we all were good at a certain role in our clique, as Lex Luger so fondly named it. A lot of people don't realize that Lex actually christened us the Click.
Wow.
Yeah, and we just embraced it. They thought it was a bad thing, and we embraced it. Yeah, that sounds cool. We're the Click. but no, I considered it an honor that Vince knew that, like, he could take a guy that he was interested in, put him in there with me on a house show run, and by the time that run was over, I could tell Vince McMahon whether the guy was, objectively tell him whether the guy was, you know, ready to move on to the next step. And that would be an Intercontinental title match run. And if he got past, and if he was that good to get past Scott, then he would get a main event title run with Diesel or Sean, whoever was the champion then. So it would all worked out perfectly. I just wish I would have gotten paid more at the time.
Well, seeing that you're in that role, who is the
but
most
I made the money. I made that money when I came back. So yeah.
No, I agree with you. My next question actually was, so who do you think? Cause you've actually worked with everyone they threw at you, and you had amazing matches. I mean, you were like one of those guys that can work with a broomstick. Is there someone that sticks out in your mind like, wow, I can't believe that this guy is who they're throwing at me. Who is the most overrated person that they threw at you in your whole tenure?
Unfortunately, and I hate to say this because I think he did, it was a lot having to do with just the circumstances, but Shane Douglas at the time. I don't know if there was just something going on in his life at the time or what the deal was, but we were really performing at a really high level. And yeah. When he came in there, I don't think he was ready for that because, like I said, we were all running on all cylinders and very few people could go toe to toe with us, like as far as, you know, having great matches. So, I just think his confidence was shot. They give him that shitty ass gimmick, the Dean gimmick, and it didn't work out. And I liked Shane too, and I still do, you know. And the only thing is like I think he blames others more than accepting, you know. Like sometimes we have to look in the mirror to, you know, when we want to figure out what happened, you know, why things went wrong. Instead of pointing fingers, because when you point your finger, you got three pointing right back at you.
Yep.
You know.
Oh, absolutely.
He was at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, it was a tough break for him, man. And he didn't handle it the best either. You know, and Scott Hall could be a real motherfucker, but if you're not having good matches with him,
surprising.
I don't care who you are. I mean, I got my ass chewed too when I screwed up in the ring with Scott Hall.
How is Scott doing? You still keep
Scott's doing great. Scott's doing great. Tomorrow we're going to be I'm going to see him in New England. 50legs.org. We're doing a fundraiser. It's actually a charity golf tournament to raise funds for the group that I work with. That we obtain prosthetic limbs for people that have gotten in accidents and we're doing this thing this weekend, and you can go to 50legs.org to check it out. It's in Westfield, Mass, and it's legit for the people that lost limbs during the Boston bombing.
Wow.
Scott and I are going to be doing, you know, some appearances this weekend for that.
Did he have his surgery yet?
He had a surgery, man. He's doing and sounding great.
Excellent. You know, I
legit too, man. Not some bullshit that you know. So many times you hear everybody's doing great and they're really full of shit. You know.
Well, we had DDP on the show a couple of weeks back, right when Scott
went into the house. Yeah, when that first video was showing up, actually.
Yeah, you know, we were really impressed with DDP. I mean, I know DDP. We've seen him a bunch of times, and what he did with Jake. I mean, I saw Jake a few months back. Jake looks like a totally different person. And I know there's some rumors out there that Jake's kind of getting on Scott Hall's nerves because you know how Jake is. But we're all rooting for Scott. I mean, everyone's rooting for him. We plugged the Kickstarter on our show. We're big fans of him. We all donated. And, you know, we really wish him the best.
That was the Indiegogo thing. That was the
Indiegogo. I'm sorry, Indiegogo.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, boy, that what a great feeling that was, like, for him to see that, like, people loved him that much, you know?
Yep. I'll tell you this.
It was really awesome.
This guy was someone that we all looked up to. I mean, I remember back in, I was probably like 17 years old, 16 years old, we're at a house show back in 94, and he throws that toothpick out, and I caught the toothpick, and I framed that thing for, like, years. I mean,
He milked the toothpick too. Like,
Oh yeah. And to me, like, I brought that to school the next day. I'm like, this is Razor Ramon's toothpick. No one believed me, but you know, I still have the fucking thing. I still have
toothpick
from my attic.
Wait, do you guys get a load of his son?
Oh, I heard.
He is a beast, you guys.
I saw him during the Iron Sheik roast when he had that whole controversy with him, and I was at the bar with Scott, and he wouldn't drink. I swear to God, he wouldn't take a drink from anyone who walked by, but he sat there, and all he wanted to talk about was Cody. And we talked for a good hour and a half, and I tried to get up to the bathroom at one point. He goes, "What the fuck are you doing? Sit down. We're talking about my goddamn son." And he said, he wants to be part of this business going forward, is to help his son because his son has more charisma. This is a quote from Scott back then. He's got more charisma and talent in his middle finger than I do in my whole entire body. So I'm really
he's got the potential to be the biggest star in the industry in years. Yep. In years. And you can take that to the bank that I said that. I mean, he's got the looks, everything. Everything. And he's going to have the rap.
Bye.
See, he just, like, right now he has nothing to talk about because he's new. So, mm-hmm. like, he's not going to be the best promo guy, but he has the presence and the charisma and he gets a job done in there, man.
Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts going back to, like, that 1995-96 era? Thoughts on Bob Holly? He just did an interview saying that, the clique used to pick on him. He's saying he alone confronted the clique, especially Kevin, and that they backed down. Again, especially Kevin. Any truth to that?
I'm not familiar with any of those events. Honestly, I'm not going to call Bob a liar. I mean, he's got his viewpoint of how things happened, and you can ask people the same version of. Different people the same story and that were there, and you're going to get a lot of different versions. That's how Bob felt. Bob had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and maybe for good reason. Like, Bob and I never really talked about it. So, I always liked Bob, even though, like, he did have that chip on his shoulder. I had no idea, like he was, like, carrying a grudge around or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And Lord knows, like, collectively the clique, I take it as a huge compliment that he said in his book that I wasn't nearly as big a prick as the rest of my friends. Like, I thought that was great. Like, that's better than just saying, oh, Sean Waltman's a really good guy. Like, to me, that's way better than just saying that. But There's a reason why a lot of different people had animosity towards us, and not all of it was justified, but some of it had to have been. They weren't wrong all the time. Yep. We must have been dicks sometimes.
Well, let's do some name games to round out that whole era. And then we'll go to Viva La Lucha, which is on Kickstarter. Name game. Give us a brief synopsis, and we name this name for you. First one out there is Ahmed Johnson. First thoughts that come to your mind.
Well, it's not a one word thing, right? Like, I can just expound on it.
No, whatever you
want to
say. Whatever you want to say.
My memories of Ahmed, and he was always a really nice guy to me and very respectful, and he had the biggest goddamn arms I'd ever seen. I thought he had implants in his triceps, I swear. But was just incredibly strong. In one of his tryout matches, Owen Hart was around, and I think Mike Rotunda was just getting tried out as an agent or something. And we were in the Houston Summit at the time. Then they turned it into the Compact Center. Then they turned it into Lakewood Church, Joel Osteen's church. But at the time, it was the Summit. And so he's out there in the ring, and right in the middle of his match, Owen gets on the headset and tells the people up in the booth, hit the music, hit the music. So Ahmed's music hits right in the middle of his match, and so he figured, I guess that means go home. So, like, he just went home, and everybody's laughing their ass off. And, we're all getting a kick out. We're all, like, having our jollies at the expense of this guy's poor tryout match, But also the time that Ahmed Johnson in Madison Square Garden beel threw me from one corner to the other to the point where my ass landed on the top turnbuckle. That's how far
Jesus
he threw me.
Christ.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Did you understand anything he said?
Yeah, I could. I could.
I'll tell you this. Back in the day,
I'm gonna leave it at that.
Back in the day, I'd get a little crazy, and then once I got a little in that mode, which I'm talking
uh-huh.
about, I would tape all the Ahmed promos and I'd watch them in a loop for about
20 to 30 minutes, and I think it was the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was just pretty good stuff. We did. Really, we had a lot stuff of pretty campy stuff that, like, if you looked at it in the proper light, like, it was, like, fun. It was funny stuff, you know?
Like the next person I'm going to ask you, Mantar. What is it? Should have talked about Mantar.
Mike Halleck, and I just saw him recently at WrestleMania, like, for the, I think it was for the Hall of Fame ceremony.
How much did he pay for
What's that?
How much did he pay for his ticket?
I don't know. I want to say he was there with one of the legends, like maybe Mad Dog or something. I can't remember.
Okay.
Because I know he was like kind of a Mad Dog Vachon disciple from Omaha, and he had some potential as a big man, but he was real green, and like they put him in a match, TV match with Scott Hall, and Scott Hall is like he's like doing his Mantar gimmick at Scott, and Scott just looks at him and just smacks the living fuck right out of him and just sits there. And it's like, what are you going to do? And fucking Mantar just froze and didn't do a thing. And it was so funny. I mean, not for him, but, you know, I mean, the situation.
Oh, my God. We can go
off and, having to carry that big buffalo head around, what a rip that was.
How do you get that through an airport?
I have no idea.
All right, let's talk Viva La Lucha. Viva La Lucha.
I want to say Kevin Kleinrock pronounces it Viva LA Lucha, but I might be wrong.
You know what? Actually, that's how it is.
There are
220, 221, whatever it takes.
I'm looking. Viva LA Lucha, pilot and web series. It's on Kickstarter right now. What we're trying to do right now is raise some money. We want to raise $60,000 in order to shoot 8 episodes of this pilot, as well as webisodes. So we have 32 days to raise this right now. And we're looking for everyone's support. We're big fans of this. And Sean,
yeah, and I'm a fan of Kevin,
what's so different about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's different in that it's not just like, you know, a Kickstarter campaign to raise some money to run a show. No, like everybody, like at a certain level of sponsorship or however you want to put it, gets a certain amount of say in what goes on, you know, and it's like an interactive thing almost, like, you know. The people that back it actually have some creative input into the situation, like as far as picking talent from overseas, from the UK, picking some of the guys from the Lucha Libre, from the World of Lucha Libre in Mexico. I don't know if they're all AAA guys or not, but, like, you know, Kevin Kleinrock is always on the cutting edge.
Yep.
of things. He always knows what's hip and what's sharp, and I have a lot of faith in the guy. And so when he came to me with this idea, I had no problem whatsoever putting my name behind it. It's not my project. I'm just happy to be a part of it. Like, I mean, so, like, the money's going to come in, and don't worry, I'm not going to, like, take all the money and go off and go on a crack binge or something.
what role do you play in the company, for people who are interested?
I'm an executive producer, which, boy, I guess that covers a lot of ground, a lot of square footage, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, because, I mean, honestly, for me, that means everything. Like, and especially helping the guys bridge the gap between the Lucha and the American, I call it the main event style. And like Rey Mysterio, he adapted to it, you know, and it's not about the moves. Like, people think, oh, you know, that means they got to change their moves. No, they can still use all the same moves they did in doing that Lucha style. It's just now I'm going to teach them how to do it to where it all makes sense. You know what I mean? I don't know if you've ever watched some of the Lucha, but, like, as big a fan of I am of it, like, there's some stuff about it that makes absolutely zero fucking sense to me. And I'm there to fucking take that part out of it. You know what I'm saying? And help teach the foreign guys, like the from the UK and from here in the States, how to blend in with with them and meet them halfway, you know. And that's the thing is there's going to be these webisodes, but there's also going to be these episodes of behind the scenes, like of us really producing, you know, not like a scripted behind the scenes thing, a real behind the scenes footage, like we're not even going to be realizing the camera shooting it, and I might be browbeating somebody because they, you know, they're being careless with the other guy, or they're fucking something up, or they're, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're going to see a lot of stuff that, like, and you're going to be privy to a lot of wisdom and knowledge that really just isn't out there, isn't really put out there.
And the best part about it is that everyone can contribute and be a big part of this, and you get updates.
Exactly.
You'll get updates on what's going on with the project. You'll get, you know, a lot of people, like you said, behind-the-scenes stuff, but at the same time, you're also going to have at certain levels where you can watch these TV tapings take place live. So you'll watch it online, live, as it's going on. And like you said, you'll see the crazy stuff that goes on during a wrestling taping. You'll see the behind-the-scenes stuff. And you know what? Once this gets on the air, the pride that you can actually have with actually being a big part of this, being a benefactor, you can start at as little as $10, and you get benefits for that. And you can go all the way up to, let's see, I think it's $10,000. And with a $10,000 pledge, you get corporate sponsorship.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a huge amount of money, but there's people out there, like in Hollywood, that's $10,000 is shit. Like, because I know what some of the pilots cost to produce. I mean, I think we spent like $800,000 producing the WSX pilot through MTV. Yeah. That's the kind of money they throw around out in Hollywood. And in our world, we can take that same amount of money and do 10 times more than they can the Hollywood way. Because, like, they're so, like, to me, they're so inefficient out there in the way they do things.
Yep.
You know, like, compared to how we do it anyways.
No, I absolutely agree. And even for, like, a mere $250, you join the matchmaking committee. There's 10 people that are available. You actually have 9 people left, so it's very limited. Where you have votes on who you're going to bring in from AAA and the UK. And there's so many other things, including Q&A sessions with Conan and Sean Waltman. And there's just so many great things that wrestling fans will never have the opportunity to be a part of unless they're joining this Kickstarter campaign. And again, all you got to do is put in Viva LA Lucha, and you'll find it on Kickstarter.com. Sean, we have a bunch of people that are dying to ask you some questions. I know we're on
Lucha. Really
comments.
Cool.
So
cool,
we got a couple
of course
from
I do,
you.
Man.
So let's get a couple questions in. We have
Viano number 5 on line 1.
Viano number 5.
Really? Because Viano number 4 is the one that kicked the shit out of me in Japan.
We got Gerard from Florida, Gerard on 1.
Hey, what's up, guys? What's up, Sean?
Hey, man, how are you, bro?
Good. Hey, I had a question. On the Surreal Life years ago, when you kind of made the guest Terrence and Peter Brady.
My finest hour.
Peter Brady went out there to kind of intervene. Like, what do you think would happen?
Keep going. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, it's cool. Like, you were totally cool about it, but if he caught you on a bad night, you think he would have just whooped his ass right there?
I would have whooped his ass that night if he actually would have came out. Like, because later on, like, when we finally had a real talk, Chris Knight and Adrian Curry and I, at a Comic-Con a few years ago, they were like, we're sorry, we didn't know she was that, we didn't know, we knew she was crazy, but we didn't know she was that fucking crazy. You know, they even knew, like, you know, they didn't know the whole story, and I apologize for showing my ass, but when you're, like, when a woman has your mind all screwed up, you know, you do stupid things, and unfortunately, you know, mine was there for the whole world to see, and a lot of that stuff was edited to make me look like much worse than the scene really was. But
then,
it would have been bad news for him that if he would have came out at that juncture.
Was any of that Surreal Life scripted? Did they tell you what to do, what to say?
No. It was. You know, you could tell you were being pushed in a certain direction, but I was never told, hey, can you redo that and say this, except for like when, except for at the end when they had me go to the door and keep knocking on the door, and then they just used it at the end as footage to make me look like this desperate jabroni, like sitting there knocking on the door, and they've like turned, they've all turned their backs on me. So like I did that, I gave them that one on a silver platter.
Well, I said we weren't going to get into this much, but we did have another
question.
That's
cool, man, because, like, everything I've done, you know, makes me what I am today. So even the bad shit, bro.
Donnie from Idaho wanted to know, what is worse, having your anus torn open or having to suck on China's penis-looking thing?
The ass, man, totally. Totally, because, like, the China thing, it was just her clitoris, and like, okay, she had an enlarged clitoris. It's not a dick. It's not a penis, you know. And a matter of fact, it made it work better. And she was damn good in bed. Like, I mean, I rate her up there pretty high. It's just that, you know, she's absolutely batshit crazy. And it's and a complete liar, especially when it comes to, you know, accusing me of rape on Howard Stern. Right. I didn't appreciate that much.
Nah.
You know?
No. Well, we'll talk about it in interview number 4. But here's we have Martha from Texas. Martha, you're on the line.
Yes, hi. Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Martha?
I'm okay, thank you. I know you just brought up the recent injury you had not too long ago. What is, like, involved in the recovery process for a sphincterplasty? Like, are you able to use the bathroom? I'm just curious. I mean, it sounds so painful, and I've never heard of the procedure before, but can you go to the bathroom? What can you do? What can't you do?
Well, now everything's working fine. I still have a couple of stitches that haven't dissolved yet up near my coccyx. I love to say that, coccyx. Anytime I can say coccyx, I love to throw it in there. But at first, when it initially happened, I mean, there was no going to the bathroom. That just was out of the question. And I think it was about 4 days till that happened. And you know, the tear was from the coccyx all the way to the inner sphincter, which is the outer and the inner sphincter, and it was touch and go whether I was going to need a colostomy bag, at least temporarily, until that healed, because, you know, eventually you have to your digestive system has to you know, go. And, and you know, when that finally happened, it was no fun. I'm not going to lie to you.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, but I had several medicines that made things softer, you know, helped me out with it. So I'm sure everybody's happy to hear about all this.
Yeah,
is this stuff turning you on, Martha?
Just curious. Well, I'm glad you're all.
You don't
better.
Have a you don't have a vibrating toy like going at the same time right now, do you?
No.
I'm just teasing, Martha.
Wow. All right, this has been an amazing interview. Like I said, this is only part one. We definitely have to have part two with you, and part three, and part four. But again, what we want to check out is Kickstarter, Viva LA Lucha. We want to get something on TV. We want to kickstart this thing. So Kickstarter.com, Viva LA Lucha. Listen, you got 32 days to go.
Yeah.
Executive producer Sean Waltman, Kevin Kleinrock's the brain behind this. And this man, I've known him for 10 years, and he's a great guy with a great mind.
You know the same thing about him that I do. Like, I mean, the guy's just, I mean, he's like a, you would think he was like a nerd, like, but he just knows, like, what he knows what's up. And I have a lot of faith in the guy. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like...
Oh, no, absolutely. I agree 100%. The guy is just, his heart is in the right place. He's not looking to really make this extravagant amount of money, because it's not going to happen right off the bat. He's looking to put his heart and soul into something that he believes in. He's a big Lucha fan, something that the United States hasn't seen in a very long time. It's a Lucha based product, and he has faith in the talent that's out there, and I have faith in exactly what he's thinking right now. So
again.
And I think WWE actually would, they would do themselves a favor, like, in a couple of ways. Number one, they would do themselves a favor in getting behind this, maybe, like, just, I mean, you know, there's ways of like, you know, contributing to things without it being part of the corporate umbrella. You know, because, I mean, it's just a nominal amount of money. And number two, like they would be doing themselves a big favor and bringing him on board, like, actually creatively. And the guy works hard. He's the kind of guy that has that work ethic that they like there, too. Yep. So I mean, they could
Cole,
really...
Can't you call Trips up and be like, hey,
yeah,
I got an idea.
That Rolodex.
Oh, I'm going to. I'm actually the next, like, because I was just talking to him the other day about some things, and, like, I'm actually going to bring it up. It's just, like, when I talk to Hunter, I like to keep, like, how's the kids and, you know, what's going on and a little bit of business, but, like, I don't like to, like, push my agenda on him, you know, because I don't want him to, every time he sees, like, it's usually he calls me or something, but, like if he sees my name, I don't want him going, oh, shit, it's kid calling, you know? Wonder what he wants now.
Yeah, what's he
want? I don't want that dynamic to our relationship, so.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, like I said, we definitely have to have part two very soon, because
we didn't touch on anything.
We hit 93 to 95. There's so much more to your career. We have so many questions, so we definitely need to have you on. Again, everyone.
Yeah, man, just tell me when. Just tell me when. I appreciate it, you guys. It's fun. It's fun doing shows where like the hosts are educated and you know and know their shit about, you know, because I mean, you know, you know when you go on a show and people, they just look up your Wikipedia and you can tell they're reading off of Wikipedia, and you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's flattering they're doing a little bit of homework, but I mean, it's nice when you guys know, like, pretty much my whole career, so I appreciate that, you guys.
We grew up with you, and we appreciate everything you've done for this business, and we look forward to seeing what you do with Viva LA Lucha, and check him out at The Real X-Pac on Twitter. And
the man.
He's the best.
The myth.
He's the best.
Thank
you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, yeah. One more thing.
Yeah.
Suck it.
Thanks so much, buddy. Sean Waltman, wow.
It's been an hour already? An
hour and 15 minutes.
Wow.
Wow, amazing, right?
Whew, I'm spent.
Well, let's get to the news real quick. Because,
really?
we got 8 minutes left, and we got Rita holding on for the news, so let's hit our theme music.
Rita.
Hey, Rita, honey, why don't you tell me, how the fuck is your news this sweet tits? Hey, how's your news?
Rita.
Hey.
It's been a while.
Great interview. Yeah, I know.
A lot of fun, right? A lot of fun with Mr. Sean Waltman, X-Pac.
Yeah, I love when the guest appreciates your knowledge and education in wrestling.
God, I mean, I wish we had 20 hours with the guy.